Good afternoon. Hope you're enjoying your lunch. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with Thomson Reuters here in Hong Kong and the Board of Governors here at the FCC. Before we get started, just a couple of quick housekeeping notes. Please do switch your cell phone to mute or off so we don't hear it buzzing during today's session. And also, just to let you know what our next event is at the club after today. On the 7th of June, we'll be showing a video screening of Portraits of Loss and the Quest for Justice. And the speaker at that event, which is in the evening, will be the executive director of Hong Kong Watch, Sharon Holmes. So do come along to that event as well. Now, on to events of today. A full house today, I can see. But the topic of today is about wage rises in China. We have seen reports of wage rises by as much as 30% in mainland China over the last year, some at 10%, 20%, but clearly a trend that's intact when it comes to manufacturing and labor. So is this the end of the manufacturing utopia that has made money for a lot of people in Hong Kong and around the world? Well, here to tell us about it is Bruce Rockowitz. He's CEO of Lian Feng Trading. He'll speak for about 20 minutes, and then we'll leave about 10, 15 minutes for questions from the audience, and we'll have you out of here at 2. Bruce?
Thanks, Tara. Hello to the press. Hi, nice to see you. First thing, it's a pleasure to be here today. It's taken you 31 years to invite me. At 50 or 60 speakers a year, I was trying to add that up in my head. Took a long time. So I hope I don't disappoint you to be the 15,000 speaker that you've had in the last 31 years. For those of you who don't know me, and I see a lot of people that I'm familiar with and friends from before, I came to Hong Kong in 1979, and a lot of people still know me from when I first got to Hong Kong. A reporter asked me last year an interesting question: what was the best investment that I ever made in my life? And I thought about it for a while, and the truth was the $800 ticket that I bought to come out to Hong Kong in 1979. And that's, if I start to do the math and how much I made on that ticket, it's been phenomenal. Hong Kong's been great for me. And it's really been my home and the place that I have, my whole career has been. And when I first got to Hong Kong, I was not the CEO of Lian Feng. Some of you know that firsthand. I came out to Hong Kong literally to play tennis. I took a semester off from school and got a job at the Hong Kong Country Club. And for 2 years, I was the pro at the Hong Kong Country Club. And still, people come up to me after 30 years and ask me to book a lesson. And in fact, Danny asked me if I could help his forehand because his backhand was the last thing I did before I went into business. And I'm sorry for that, Danny. What I can say is that I started as a tennis pro, and like a lot of stories in Hong Kong, I started with nothing and met a man named Alan Zeman, who all of you know him, I think, at this point. He helped develop what's right next to this club. Lan Kwai Feng, and he hired a young Canadian to come into the business with him and help build a business that what we focused on through the 80s, the 90s, was on the supply chain. And basically my whole career has been with one company, because in the year 2000, that company that we built together was called Colby. In the year 2000, we merged with Lian Feng. And quite frankly, it was a 3-year deal, and a very typical. It was the largest deal that Lian Feng at the time had ever done. I thought that after 3 years, I'll be done, and wouldn't be speaking here today. I'll be playing tennis somewhere or golf. And the truth is, it was so addictive I eventually became the head of Lian Feng. And so I would say that my whole career has been based on the supply chain. And today, what I really want to take you through, and quickly through sort of the history of what went on in the world, because you have to know where we were to know where we're going. And I break the world of production, sourcing, whatever you want to call it, into three eras. And the first era, and China revolves around every one of the eras. China was key throughout every one of the eras. The first era was in 1948. And 1948 is when, all of you know, China closed its doors to the world. And the reason why I say that it revolves around China, even that era, and that was a 30-year era that we've lived through during that period of time. And I wasn't working at the time. I was in school, and it was before I was born, part of that era. But during that time, China not only dropped off the map from a export point of view, but from a consumption point of view. So for 30 years, the world lived without China. 1.2 billion people were really dead to the world. In 1948, China lost 97% of its GDP. 97%. Can you imagine? One of the biggest economies in the world went away. And that basically, that first era was a time that people produced and consumed in the same country. And that's a very unusual concept today. United States, Europe, produced and manufactured everything that they wear, everything that's in their home. Most of you are, don't even remember those days. That's how the world was. And so basically, in that end of that 30-year period, which really ended when China opened up in 1978, that's really when that period ended. And why it ended was because in the United States, the inflationary pressures were getting really strong. Cost of goods were going up. As a kid, I grew up with prices going up every year. The last 30 years, which is the next one I'm going to talk about, was quite different than that. So you really had a world that was, you had very large factories in the United States and Europe, very large, vertical factories, very inflexible factories, factories that basically made what they wanted to make as opposed to making what the consumer wanted. And that's what the world was like. And so actually it was a very, fashion was very hard to make at that time. It was very hard to do because you can only do what a factory wanted to make. And then China opened up, and that started a whole real revolution of offshoring production. And that offshoring of production has been the key driver of global exports and trade. And think about it. In the new era, not the new era, in the second era between 1978 until the last 2 years, what happened was the world divided up into consuming countries and producing countries. That's what really happened to the world. And it was a pretty separate world. All China did was, basically export and produce. And it didn't start with China. Production started in Hong Kong. You could say Japan, but it was way before that. But really, the whole production manufacturing industry started here in Hong Kong. Lian Feng is a company, like many of the companies in Hong Kong, that built and was part of the fabric of society. It's only the last 20 or 30 years that society was built on real estate and banking in Hong Kong. The export sector, and you look at the people in key places in politics here, they came from the export side. They came from the apparel side. That's what really built sort of Hong Kong. And as Hong Kong became expensive, we moved to Taiwan. And then when Taiwan became expensive, we moved to Korea, and so forth. And that started the global sourcing process. And eventually, Hong Kong became expensive, Taiwan became expensive, Korea, and so forth. And simultaneously, China started to get better at what it did. And what was created in southern China is something in manufacturing that probably will never be replicated. Southern China got the know-how of three incredible worlds of production. The Hong Kong people, the Taiwan people, the Korean people, they all converged on China simultaneously to an area that had very little labor. All the workforce was migrant workforce. So you brought the know-how almost overnight, and the industries of Hong Kong, Taiwan, Korea, they survived, but they did no manufacturing. And they survive to this day, but they do no manufacturing. And that era really caused what I would say a 30-year deflationary cycle in the world, that the cost of goods for what you wear and what you use in your home continued to go down because China, you know, got more and more robust, more and more factories, more labor migrated, more know-how from Taiwan, Hong Kong, etc. caused something, the density of the factories in southern China is nothing that compares to that and probably will ever compare to that. It was a timing. It was a moment in time where China opened and hadn't been opened before, and you had all this pent-up knowledge and technical knowledge with nowhere to go but there. And so it migrated there. And this era was a real boom for lower prices in the consumer market in the United States. But what it really did, it actually hurt China and U.S. relationship through that period of time. The imbalance, you know, U.S. looked at it as taking jobs from the United States. And the truth is, the jobs would have gone, if it didn't go to China, it would have gone somewhere else. They really would. And so that imbalance, as everyone knows, became a real thorn in the relationship between China and the U.S. and the trade deficit swelled and continued to swell. And at the same time, China became prosperous. And I would say the era, that 30-year era, that deflationary era, has come to an end to some extent. It really has come to an end. And what has happened is China has now entered the world of consumption. And so it's doing two things. China, number one, is consuming labor. You know, labor is going to the local market. It's also people that used to do jobs in the factories have a choice because China's booming. As well, it's eating up commodities, cotton, things like that, things that we need. Because for many years it didn't consume. So this new era, which I would say started around 2008, and really two things happened. The world went into a deflationary, basically we had a great recession in the world. And that great recession put a lot of pressure on jobs in China and jobs everywhere. And the focus of China became less outward and more inward, and building the consumption in China became more important than the export to China. And that was one thing that started the new era, the world recession. But also something that happened in 2009 was, which a lot of you read about, was Foxconn. And it was a factory that does a lot of goods for Apple. And the Foxconn had a spate of suicides in their factory. And that basically put a lot of spotlight on the way factories are run and what was causing those suicides. And the truth is, as time went on, it wasn't really the cost of labor. They paid people a lot more. They raised their salaries 50%, 60%. They gave them bonuses, but the suicides persist. And what they realize is that there's some fundamental social issues when you move and house 500,000 people, and all they do is work and then go back to their dormitory, work and go back to the dormitory, and they don't have family, and they don't have and China was created on migrant workers that moved away from their family, and that's how the whole South was created. And both the Foxconn happening, as well as the world going into this great recession, is causing a lot of change, causing a lot of change. And this new era, and I really say it's a new era. And the last two eras were 30 years. We may be in it for another 30-year era, where China has becomes one of the largest consumers. And that's going to have profound effect on everything, on competition for labor, on competition for commodities, etc. So what started to happen in 2008 is prices started to go up because wages are going up. And if you look at the next 5 years, China's wages will continue to go up. If you look at the five-year plan, China's internal five-year plan, they are programming the minimum wage to go up at least 13-14% for the next 5 years. So we know labor's going up. And what has it's caused a number of factory owners to rethink what they're going to do. And what you're seeing now is a major shift. This new era is a major shift. It's not, you know, we could talk about Foxconn, we could talk about commodity prices, we can talk about higher labor. It's much bigger than that. This is a major shift of where production is going to be in the future. And I can say, over time, consumer goods production will migrate quickly away from the southern border here. And what will happen is, it's you know, people ask me, where's it going to? One thing, you know, of course, is outside of China, places like Vietnam, Bangladesh, Indonesia. But it's also going very quickly, rapidly to the west of China, to where the labor is, to get away from this whole migratory movement of people, going and putting factories where it used to be, where the people used to live, and where they are living today. And this new cycle is not it's not cyclical. This is really a permanent new era where production is going to be based will change. And if you look at Hong Kong basically lost all its production, pretty much, and survived pretty well. And what I believe will happen in the southern part of China, and really the whole coast, is it'll move up the value chain. It'll focus on other industries, service industries, consumption, retail, but it also will move up into higher, more expensive goods. Higher-end goods, and you know, I say to people, if U.S. was worried about China producing cheap goods, that they should be worried about China producing better goods, because that's really huge competition to what U.S. does today. Industries, the automobile industries, planes, high tech. China will in the coast. Will be moving, we believe, to those type of industries. It will not go away. There'll still be plenty of industry in this part of the South, but the real consumer goods production will move to the West, and will move fairly rapidly. You know, people ask me if you look at China 5 years from now, what percentage today? Li and Feng does about 50% of our exports. From China, and 50% of our exports from the rest of the world. And the rest of the world is about 40 or 50 countries. And the rest of the world is equal to one China. So there is, you know, and when you scour the globe, you know, what's next? There is no real next. We're not going to find another China. What's next is actually automation, efficiency, getting the goods quicker, faster, making sure that people that they buy, the quality is better. So it's moving up the value chain, and that's a worldwide phenomenon. that's happening, and China's going to play a big part of that. The China in 5 years will probably still be about 50% of the goods for Li and Feng. It's definitely not going away. It's definitely not. There is no viable alternative on the scale of China, and I think the future is not chasing lower and lower prices. It's actually getting better and better quality, better speed to the market, and producing goods that last much longer than throwaway fashion that's been going on. It's better for the environment. It's better for the consumer in the long run. Those are the things that are happening today. The one thing about the supply chain is that you have to be very flexible. Things are changing very rapidly, and it's a difficult business if you're not flexible, because of what goes on between countries and within countries, and what's going on today. But we think that China basically will be a growth vehicle and a real catalyst for growth for the next years ahead of us, both from a consumption point of view and a supply point of view. And I truly believe if I came back in 5 years, I would say the same thing, that China is firmly in place in the world, and I think it is good for the world to have a China. Okay, I think I did 20 minutes. Is that right?
On the dot. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
So we'll open it up for Q&A. There are microphones, so please raise your hand and tell us your name and your organization. I'll try to make sure I get both sides of the room evenly. Why don't we start right down the middle here in the white shirt?
Hi, thanks very much. My name is Simon Cox from The Economist magazine. I was interested really in two points. The first, you mentioned the importance of the sort of density of factories in southern China, that was very difficult to replicate. Will that not slow the migration of factories inland, given how difficult it is to create that density? Second, when you say consumer goods production will move west, what do you mean by west? I mean, do you mean Anhui? Do you mean Chongqing? How far west?
You know, initially, a place like Chengdu, Hunan, Henan, like that, but initially, all of the west will be covered. And when you talk about the migration, this next move is the hardest. Like you said, it is a hard move, and that's why it's not moving away from southern China as rapidly as you would think, because the ability to build factories quickly at that level of quality that southern China can do is very hard, and to do it in one place will never happen anymore. So there's a real reluctance for factory owners to move, and there's a reluctance of customers to move at this moment, but there's so much pressure on prices that it's forcing the move, and so it would be more rapid if there was a more of a government intervention that says, okay, we're going to be moving this to certain areas of China, and really focused on that, and gave a lot of benefit to factories to move. I think then it would be a more concerted effort, and probably better for the industry. But I don't see that happening at this moment.
Over here, Mike.
Hi there, Mike Flaherty from Reuters. The question is, in terms of moving manufacturing away from China, given wage inflation, we've heard a lot of companies and entrepreneurs who have done that, but I guess we're also hearing now that they're coming back to China because they found places like Vietnam and Indonesia to be, I don't know, I guess there are quality issues, there's distribution issues. So I'd like to hear from you. Is that a trend you're seeing? Have you yourself experienced that? And, you know, is the trend going to be everybody just comes back to China?
You know, the thing about how important China is that for the last 30 years, everybody really competed. When I say everybody, a Vietnam, a Bangladesh, Indonesia, they competed with China. So as China exported lower and lower prices, everybody brought their prices down to China to compete with them. And so goes the other way. As China comes up in price, all the other countries are coming up in price. And it's not it's labor. You know, Bangladesh, the increase in labor percentage-wise is much higher than the increase in China. And so you're seeing the whole industry re-rate itself. It's all coming up simultaneously. Some people are moving back. I don't see it as a major trend at all. But I think that it will be a trend when the West becomes more developed, and there will be some movement back to China. The thing is, every country is sort of relatively small outside of China. So they have a tendency to get overbooked much quicker than China. China is endless. It's limitless. It used to be, at least. And that, because of the population and because of the size and because of how much they've developed. You go to a place like a Bangladesh today, it's booming. It's booming. I mean, it's doing unbelievable. Vietnam, booming. So they're, all the production countries of the world that are really leaders in production are booming. So it gets to a point where, you know, maybe it's better to move back to China, maybe it's better to move out of China, but they're all pretty, in comparison to each other, pretty similar.
On that note, Bruce, let me just slip a quick question. And when you say prices are going up everywhere as a result, is there any way to quantify by how much prices for goods such as textiles, et cetera, are really going to go up over the next few years? Are we going to see?
You know, first it came down a lot. So you're now just catching up to where they used to be. Especially in 2008, when the world went into recession, everything kind of dropped down. Even employees' wages dropped down. So they're catching up. And what we see today, if you look at this year versus last year, and this is just the way we look at our own goods, is we're up about 15% in cost, which is passed on to the retailer. So that's a big increase. If you go back, sort of the past, it's been minus 5 to 10% a year deflation. So now you have not only a reverse, but a huge reverse. I think this is going to moderate, and it's starting to moderate, because as prices go up, people buy less units. When they buy less units, they use less commodities, and they also use less factory space. And so that causes the prices to moderate. But the long-term trend, you know, is 5-6% a year up, probably, over the next 5 years. But you have to mitigate that with alternative sourcing, because I don't believe a consumer in the United States or Europe is prepared to pay more at this point.
Over here.
Yes, Jane Singer from Inside Fashion.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
This is an excellent presentation.
Thank
and
you.
It's particularly relevant to what we cover. But I was just wondering, from your point of view, we've talked about China as a producer for export, which is primarily what it's been doing since it's opened up. But now China's becoming, as you noted, a big consumer. How is that going to impact upon availability of factory capacity and so on? I would imagine now that manufacturers have an option to sell domestically.
You know, historically, the factories that sell domestically are different than the factories that export, and China's been pretty clear about that. And so it's not so easy for an export factory to sell locally at this moment. Over time, that will change. There's no doubt about it. But there's definitely a competition for labor, you know, between the factories. And there's definitely a competition for factory owners to say, you know what, it's a lot easier to sell to China than to sell to, you know, some of these American customers, because for many reasons. And so it is definitely a changing world of competition for space, factory space, for commodities. One thing that's been interesting about this business is that production was always a commodity. It was endless, and everyone felt that there was an endless supply of production in the world. I think the realization is that it's not. Because China opened up, it was so much people, but you know, China is getting more expensive, and so is the rest of the world.
Over here in the black dress.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Sophie. I'm from Bloomberg News. Hi.
Hi.
So you mentioned about Vietnam and Bangladesh, and you said that they're booming, but how concerned are you about a rash of strikes in Vietnam, and where workers are paying for, you know, demanding for higher pay to compensate for the highest inflation in Asia? And does this make Bangladesh more attractive? Thank you.
You know, I think every labor base right now is much more hooked into the world through the internet, Facebook, through what's going on. I think there's no more secrets that somebody gets paid something in China, and it spreads out the news fairly quickly. So the issue of labor getting paid more is happening not just in Vietnam. It's happening in Bangladesh. It's happening in many countries, that there is definitely a push for people that work in factories to get paid more. And I think it is a fact of life. People aspire to want more, need more. As I said, they're much more connected to what's going on in the world. They're making a expensive item, and they know what they're getting paid to make that item, and they know what it sells for in the United States. That used to be all fragmented. It's not anymore. And so that's another cause of labor prices going up. But it's competitive, and it's every country is going through it today. And I don't think it's a bad thing for the business for the deflationary sort of world to end. I think that it needs a little bit of inflation. It was not healthy the last 20 or 30 years.
Over here in the back, James.
Hi, Bruce. James Pomfret from Reuters. I've just got a question about how you see the future of electronics contract manufacturing in China. Over the past few years, we've seen Foxconn. It's been straddled by problems. Which you mentioned the suicides, and recently there were some safety issues there. Despite being such a dragonhead, Foxconn has struggled to maintain its profitability in China. And I'm just wondering, what strategies are available to the likes of these big players in sort of reinventing themselves or raising their game? Brand building, maybe, innovation?
First thing is, I'm not really the person to comment on the electronics industry, because that's one of the areas that we don't do. But what's happening there is a need to diversify their production, and so they will, and they've already announced it, be moving parts of their production away from where it is today and towards where the population is, so that the lifestyle of their workers is better, and I think that you have to take human nature into accord when you're building factories today. Things have changed. As far as what they're going to do, I really can't comment.
We had a gentleman over here in a tie first.
Hi, Abhik Bhattacharya from the Wall Street Journal. I actually just want to piggyback on that question and talk about if you can address supply chain diversity. For instance, Apple relies only on Foxconn, and I'm wondering if that's a good idea. So that's perhaps corporate diversity. The other question is geographic diversity, and that's something that's come to light after the Japan earthquake. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, we as a company believe in that you have to be a global, for any kind of brand or retailer, you need to source globally because of the things you just mentioned. You need diversification. Things happen. Things change. You know, if you were all in Thailand during all the riots there, you'd have a problem. And if you were in Bangladesh when they were rioting there, you'd have a problem. And typically in Lianfeng, on any one day, somewhere, there is a coup, a rebellion, a flood, every single day. Because why? We're in countries that are third world countries that are developing, and that's what happens. And so I think every retailer or brand knows that they need to diversify. And it's diversification not necessarily only by country, but it could be multiple factories within a country or multiple places within a country. apparel business is a very diversified business. Why? Because for 40 years, there was a thing called quota. Quota was a restriction by the U.S. and Europe. If you had it, it was a benefit. You had the ability to ship to the United States X amount of garments. If you didn't have it, it was a restriction. That caused everybody to diversify because they would run out of quota in China. They had to go to Bangladesh. They have to go to Indonesia. So the apparel industry is very diversified and very global. The electronic industry is not, because you didn't have those restrictions. And so you never felt the pressure because of those restrictions weren't there. And the best country to go to, and easiest and most efficient, has always been China. So why go anywhere else? That's always been the thing. And so yes, people are diversifying, and we put all our customers into multiple countries.
In the back here.
Good afternoon. My name is Florence de Changy. I report for Le Monde in Paris.
Hi.
Just coming back to the three eras that you mentioned, they are clearly economical but also political eras. So could you elaborate a little bit on how do you see politically this third era, which just started 2 years ago, especially related to China?
Well, I'm a businessman, so I think that in one respect, I think that the more China consumes, the better the relationship with the United States and Europe. And that's what this era is. It's an era of China consumption. So I think it could be an improvement in the relationship. But again, politics have a lot to do with who's in power at the time. So it's hard to, we have another election coming up in the United States next year. It depends who gets into power, really.
Francis?
Oh, Francis Moriarty, RTHK. I've got two questions. Looking at this question of rising costs, and the focus is on labor price is a concern, I would have thought two things. First of all, that rising wages in China's context would be a cause for less concern because it addresses questions of social division. You have the harmony factor. You have people feeling better about their lives, and this has social stability consequences. So I'm wondering to what degree these rising costs are actually good rather than bad. And secondly, I'm wondering at what point when you look at the total price increase, the 15% figure that you mentioned before, what percentage of that is labor? Because you've got rising demand for commodities, you've got rising power costs, you've got petrol costs, you've got shipping, which is something you're very concerned about. What percentage of the total cost actually is driven by labor? And my last question is, where's the point at which you look at all those costs, start making somebody say, maybe I should move my source of production back to where my consumption is, rather than keeping it half a world away?
Yeah. Okay, I'll try to remember all the questions. The first question, well, I'll go backwards. You talk about is it good thing for the labor prices to go up, and I think for China it's a very good thing. It's definitely, it's exactly what they want to happen. That's why they're actually allowing it to happen, and they're supporting increased wages in China, because like you said, it puts more money in the pockets of the workers who then spend. And you build a consumption market as opposed to only an export market. So I think it's healthy for all parties that this happens, and so and I think it's the right thing. It's re-rating all the different parties and who shares in what on making a garment or whatever it may be. As far as the increase in prices, based on is it 15%? You know, what percent is commodity prices? What percent is labor? The truth is, it depends on the item. If you talk about like textiles, 90% is the like a towel. There's very little labor, so it's all the increase is based because of commodity. Children's clothing is less labor and uses a lot of cotton. Same. It's gone up a lot because of the commodity prices. So you have both commodity prices going up and labor going up. And to some extent, it depends on what the commodity prices are, how it all balances. And so the easy answer is 50-50, but it really depends specifically by item, what you're making, what's the component of labor, what's the component of the commodity. And so there's no simple answer to that. But I would say both were very important, both commodity and both labor. And the commodity price will sort itself out, because over time people plant more cotton, and if it's worthwhile, the price will come down. But labor is something that we're going to live with going up. That's for sure. What was the third question?
Where's the point at which, when you add up these price increases, you say to yourself, maybe I'm better off moving back to the source of consumption?
You know, it's a long way off, and I don't believe that production for the type of goods that at least Lian Feng does will move back to the United States. And I think most people would agree on that, mainly because of the workforce. The Western world does not have the workforce to do this type of business, or the interest. And you go back, like in Europe, all the better brands, what they're struggling to be made in Italy, the workers are very old right now. And there's no new workers coming in that want to do that business. So where do you do, Hermes bags, if you can't do it in Italy, and things like that. So that's a real struggle right now. And as much as people would like it to go back, in some cases, there's just not the workforce. So I think in the consumer goods area, it's probably not going to happen. At any price, but I think at higher, bigger items, whether it's planes, cars, technology, those could move back, or may not.
Time for one last question, Keith.
Okay. Keith Bradshaw, New York Times. Could you just talk a little more on India? Almost the same population as China. It's going to pass China in terms of young workers. 8% GDP growth. You never mention it in terms of an alternative to China.
Yeah, India, to me, is it's an important office for Lian Feng, but could be a lot better from the point of view of the scale. India, second largest population in the world, has a pretty good workforce, but the infrastructure has been really poor. The ease of building big factories is difficult because of labor problems. The government of China, I think, is perfectly suited to carry out what they say they're going to do, and with infrastructure and things like that. And India's had a hard time doing what they say they can do, as much as they want to. So proof is sort of in the pudding. The business just doesn't grow like China, just doesn't. And I don't see it really. It's a billion-dollar business for Lian Feng. But I don't see, it'll grow 20-30% a year, but I don't think it'll surpass a China or even come close to a China.
Bruce, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We have a gift for you from the FCC. Okay. I haven't checked to see whether it is made in China, but do let me know. And we hope to have you back before another 15 years.
Yeah, thank you. 31. Thank you.